was the previous night, or I guess could have been that same night still. I guess it depends on when you count the next day starting, but we definitely talked about it last week when Jesus and his disciples were having their final meal together, and Jesus reveals that he's going to be betrayed, and everyone is confused by this, and Peter speaks up, and he uses his spiritual gift, which is putting his foot in his mouth, by basically declaring his loyalty to Jesus to the point that if it comes to it, he will go and die with Jesus. And Jesus turns to him and says, "Before the rooster crows, you will have denied that you know me three times." Now, there's an interesting kind of historical problem here. And it's interesting because it has a payoff that I think is pretty profound. The chickens, and therefore roosters, aren't really allowed in Jerusalem at the time of the temple. So, you know, I'm sorry, but our lovely painting here has, I think, three that I can count. And that's because chickens are messy. They just go wherever they want, and then they poop wherever they want. And when you have the temple, the most holy place in the universe, really the center of the universe if you're Jewish, cleanliness is a very big deal. And so chickens they're not allowed in the city. And this has raised questions here and there about, well, what's going on here? And as it turns out, you can find the answer in this huge volume of writing called the Mishnah, which is a collection of sayings and arguments and discussions of the sages and rabbis trying to figure out how to interpret and understand God's commandments or his teaching, Torah. And a lot of the conversations, or some of them anyway, predate Jesus by quite a lot, and then some of them come after Jesus by a little bit, which makes it sometimes helpful. And interestingly, it seems like that phrase, the rooster crowing, is an idiom that has gotten passed down and its original meaning is lost. This happens in English. If I meet somebody and something goes weird with that conversation and then we just don't like each other, I would say, well, we got off on the wrong foot. I don't know why we say that. I don't know what that means. I'm sure somebody here does. So why do we say that? Well, it's just an idiom. That's how language works. We might say, well, we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. I think that comes from like World War II or something like that, but I'm just making that up, kind of. That's one of those, like, I thought I heard that somewhere things. But why do we say that? Well, its original meaning we don't know anymore. Or at the very least, it's irrelevant. So the rabbis, these sages, after the temple had been destroyed, maybe a generation or two, were discussing this phrase. And they come to the conclusion, and they seem to be right, quite right actually, that it refers to not an actual rooster, but the person who is designated to be kind of the town crier, but for the temple, to call the people to prayer. So, I mean, at least from my perspective, he's the poor schmuck that has to wake up like at O Dark 30 and wake everybody else up, because I don't like to get up, and call everyone who would come and approach the place of God's presence for prayer. That feels really significant. Because think about what Jesus said to Peter and then what plays out before you hear the call to come and approach the Father, you will have denied that you know me 3 times. Oh, that's so much worse. So nevertheless, Jesus is grabbed by the temple guard. They're taken to the high priest's house. This is the same house a generation later, which Jesus predicts, by the way, that the rebels will storm and execute the high priest before the entire city is destroyed. And if you're a high priest, it means you've got a lot of money, and because you're the high priest, because you were able to grease the palms of the Roman overlords and make that happen. So of course you have a courtyard, and people are just kind of gathering around, probably curious to see what happens. And Peter can't let go, which does speak to a sense of loyalty. We learn in another gospel that John he knows somebody on the inside, so he's able to get in closer. I think this also indicates that John is young, because he's not quite in danger like the other disciples would be. But that's a conversation for another time. So Peter gets as close as he can, safely. The only reason why he would do that is because he really does love Jesus. And while they're in there and Jesus is being mocked and beaten, they start a fire. And he gets identified 3 times. The first one, the woman seems to maybe have seen him with Jesus. I don't know. The second one, same thing. The third one, the third time they go, "You're Galilean and you're here, so you clearly are with Jesus." I guess maybe his style of dress, or probably more likely his accent, gave him away. Just like if somebody is like a born and bred Cajun from New Orleans, you're going to tell in 2 seconds by the way they talk. And so Peter 3 times says, "No, I don't know him." And Luke, as he's narrating the story, gives just this awful detail that after he says that, the rooster crows, the cry to prayer, and Jesus looks at him. Oh. And he weeps. I'm a massive nerd in a lot of different ways. And I like fiddling with electronics. I like messing with things, building like little robotics things. And I built a thing or two, like with my guitar set up and programmed it and all of that. So I know my way around electronics. And I like to really tinker. I am no Phil Pelsman. Just if you know who that is, then you know. I will, of course, never go anywhere near the high voltage crazy stuff he does. And I'm sure he could run circles around me otherwise. But I'm no Phil Pelsman, but I'm at least pretty good. And I remember a little while ago, I was doing something, hooking some stuff up, and kind of looked over and saw these two leads that were exposed and thought, huh, and then plugged something in and flipped it on, and then, of course, bam, and sparks fly everywhere. Oh, because, of course, they would. I'm sitting there just looking at it, going, unplugging it. And then had this moment of, I thought I was smarter than that. Clearly, I'm not. What do you think Peter's thinking in that moment? He thought he was more loyal than that. Thought he was more courageous. How do you come back from that? I mean, he does love Jesus. But whether that love has its limits, or his fear overcame that love, or he thought he was courageous and it just turns out he's not. He's not who he thought he was. And I think that horrible, horrible moment when he's just staring at Jesus and then remembering his words. Those are those moments when you find out who you really are, and not in a good way. Pretty much all of us here are old enough that we've had those moments. We have like these boxes of characteristics. Like fidelity and loyalty, courage, love, compassion, kindness, gentleness, like these really, really good characteristics. And because most of us, most of the time, tend to see ourselves as the hero of our own stories, it's very easy to just kind of assume that those characteristics will apply to me. Because why wouldn't they? Until we hit a wall. We hit a wall of experience that tells us maybe that's not the case. I mean, you might think you have compassion and love for somebody. You have understanding for their plight and their situation. But then as they continue to struggle and they can't get it together, and you thought you loved them and had compassion on them, only to find out that you're just yelling at them. You kind of have a choice there. You can either blame them, which is what a lot of us do, or you can say, you know what, maybe the problem is in me. Same with issues of honesty or fidelity or something like that. You'd tell yourself, well, I'd never steal, I'd never cheat, I'd never do any of these things. And then an opportunity that could really, boy, that would be a big benefit, even though it really bends some things and flat out breaks some other things. In other words, you're faced with real temptation, not fake temptation that, you know, whatever. But real temptation, and you give in, and you can blame your situation. You can say, well, I needed this because I can try to justify my actions, or you can just admit the truth, which is maybe I'm not who I thought I was. Peter is in this moment. And I think the beauty of Lent is that it's a time of the year where we kind of just naturally will take a step back and ask some of these harder questions about ourselves. Not to just navel gaze and make it all about us. But if we take seriously the path that Jesus takes to his own death, and we really believe that he's dying for us and in our place, then it stands to reason we should probably ask why he would need to, and not in a general sense, like, oh, because I'm a sinner. Yeah. That doesn't mean anything if you say it enough times, but I mean it's time to really dig in. We have something kind of working against us right now, a little bit anyway, within our culture. You can call it a couple of different things, but you might call it the therapeutic in a really abstract way. Language that kind of mimics therapy. There's a lot more consciousness and awareness of the process of therapy within our culture. And there are a lot of really, really good things that come out of that. I tend to think, by and large, it's a positive change in our culture. By and large. But there's there are a couple of places that I think are maybe not quite so helpful. And that's a very, very subtle, not funny joke, because saying, well, I don't think that's quite helpful is a very therapeutic way of saying that. It's not that funny, so please don't laugh, but whatever. And that is, sometimes, in an attempt to curb or stop ourselves from being just genuinely abusive to ourselves, like, you know, these are the types that just really beat themselves up, and I would know, I am one of them. We tend to take all self-talk or self-reflection that might paint us in a negative light and label that as bad or not helpful or whatever and try to push it away. Now, in some cases, if somebody just is really hard on themselves to the point where it is just locking them up and they can't thrive or really even exist, then yeah, there's a place for that and there's a conversation to have there. But it's had this unfortunate knock-on effect where people seem less willing to be really reflective. And we seem to be pretty hesitant to have this moment that Peter is having, where he is confronted with this cold, hard reality that he is not who he thought he was. And he has nobody to blame but himself. So my first thought, my first question would be, when is it easier to just try and blame somebody else or something else instead of confront ourselves? The easy and kind of dumb example that we're probably all familiar with is you're stuck in traffic. Well, is it because everybody else is a terrible driver? Now, this is Albuquerque, so there could be some truth to that. Or is it the fact that I can't manage my own frustration, my own sense of impatience? Ding, 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 it's that one. Just FYI. We'll if you have children or have had, you know, or they're grown or whatever, you imagine that you're going to be this awesome parent and you're not going to make the mistakes that your parents made even though they were good parents and blah blah blah, and then you have kids and they turn like three and you're just screaming at them and you're going, well, I'm not the parent that I thought I was. We could spend hours going through different scenarios where we thought we would stick up for that person, or we thought we would stand and fight for this cause that we believe in, but we realize now it's going to really inconvenience us, so maybe we'll take a step back. Oh, I thought I was braver than that, or I thought I was nicer than that, or why did I explode at that person? Well, again, suppressing that natural human inclination to blame something else, and avoiding the temptation to just sort of therapize it away so that I don't have to actually reflect on who I am, really. We have our Peter moment when we're not who we thought we were. Now, as I've been thinking through this, coming back to that moment, that little detail that Luke slips in, which is very much a Luke thing. He likes to do this, of Jesus seeing him. And Luke doesn't even need to tell us. Like, we know that Jesus knows that moment. What kind of look do you think that was? You know, because, like, looks can speak volumes. They can speak paragraphs. Like my teachers when I was in elementary school would give me looks, and they said a lot, and what they said was not good. I mean, there's no way to know for sure. The only thing that we could maybe use to try and understand what his look says to Peter is by trying to figure out, or is by looking at what Jesus does after that. Jesus stays the course. He doesn't throw his hands down and says, you know what, you're not worth it. I'm out of here. Which I think speaks at least a little bit. And then long after the most important moment in human history, when Jesus is raised from the dead and Peter runs to the tomb, and even though he's outpaced by John, again suggesting John is younger, John kind of starts, he's kind of staring like in, and Peter's like, is he back? Is he alive? I need him. And he just runs right in. That speaks volumes, but he's not there. And then when they have their conversation, Jesus unwinds Peter's denial by asking him three times, do you love me? And then commissioning him as essentially the leader of the disciples. So given what we know, it would suggest that Jesus' look at Peter is one of compassion. And this is the thing that I think our sort of therapeutically minded culture, which again, I'm not strictly against. I think it has a lot of good things that it brings, a lot of Christian things, to be perfectly honest. But there are some blind spots, and this is one of them. That there's immense freedom in first just being honest about who we are not when we are confronted with that moment. Like, I am not as courageous as I thought. I am not as compassionate. I'm not as generous. I'm not as kind. I'm not as loyal. I'm not as faithful. You know, what, fill in the blank. There is immense freedom in first being able to say that. Like that's why, like in 12-step programs, the first step is to admit your problem. And I think everyone I've known that's been in recovery will say that's usually the hardest. But then, after being able to admit that and getting that off our chest, then we have the equal parts terrible and just fundamentally healing experience of Jesus' compassion. And I say terrible not because it's bad, but because it's so vulnerable. So again, maybe Lent is a time to remind ourselves that maybe we're not who we think we are. And not in the sense of, well, I might think I'm perfect, but I'm actually sinful, woe is me. That's just piety. That's meaningless. But I mean specifically, because that's where the rubber meets the road. Another idiom. And as we make our way through the season of Lent, where our minds turn to moments and experiences like this, we're headed towards the cross, we're headed towards the ultimate expression of God's compassion. Jesus, to get to that point, will demonstrate a kind of loyalty, faithfulness, love, compassion, and kindness that we are not capable of. And he does it for us. Even when we have our Peter moments, that love, that kindness, compassion, that loyalty that Jesus has that takes him to his death is still very real. Amen. As you are able, please rise.